$4 or 3 for 10. Mask filters, $6 or 3 for 15. Save big on British chemical suits, only $12. Israeli gas masks, $20. Trigger finger gloves, $5 a pair or $36 a dozen. Snowshoe binding for $8 or $48 a dozen. And so much more. Even hard to find surplus items, all at surplus prices. Preparing the whole family has never been so affordable at MaineMilitary.com.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Jerome Corsi. And Dr. Corsi graduated from Harvard, and I believe it was in political science, wasn't it?
Yes, Todd.
All right, fine. And, of course, now he writes regularly for WorldNet Daily. He's written a number of books, which we actually carry here, including The Late Great USA. But tonight I thought we'd hope that Dr. Corsi could talk to us about what's happening financially as far as our nation and where he thinks we are headed. Because, of course, we're told this evening, my goodness, things are wonderful. Why, we only lost 534,000 jobs this last month, you know. Why, the month before that, we lost 670,000 jobs. And the month before that, 670,000 and 740,000 a month. Before that, why, things are sort of getting lots better. We're losing far less jobs. But are things really going to improve just by spending massive amounts of money? And what's that going to do to the value of our currency? And, well, why don't you pick up the story for us?
Well, Dr. Stan, it's good to talk to you. I was watching the unemployment statistics today. You know, it's now at 8.9% of the workforce is unemployed. It's 13 million people. And the idea that Wall Street is celebrating because there's only somewhat over 500,000 people that lost jobs in April is really fairly ridiculous. They're trying to say, well, the rate of decline is slowing. But if you look carefully at the statistics, there were still over 600,000 jobs lost in the private economy. And the jobs that were made up last month came from government jobs. So clearly, with the Barack Obama administration trying to expand government, we're going to get some government employment. But government employment is really not productive employment in the economy. It's economy that's paid for by tax revenue. So the idea that the employment coming from government workers, that that's where our new jobs are going to come from, this is going to be a very long and very sluggish recovery, and I don't think it's a recovery at all. I think this is, again, just manipulation of the numbers and the attempt to pump up what is a bear rally. I don't think this rally is one that can be relied on. I predicted in my Red Alert newsletter, if you go to redalert.wnd.com, I've been predicting that the stock market would get to 8,500, which it closed at today, at 8,500 and a little bit more. But I'm very doubtful that it's going to get to a reliable 9,000, because I think that there's just too much negative news in the economy, which is being largely papered over by an attempt to happy talk the economy by the Obama administration. And I'll give you a couple of examples, actually, Dan. The stress tests that were just completed, I think, were really pretty much of a public relations fraud. The banks just got relief because the rules were changed, and these stress tests were not very rigorous at all.
And I really think that's so important. Basically, of course, the banks are supposed to determine what their assets are worth, and instead of trying to assess them according to the market value, they could put any value they wanted to it. They call it not mark-to-market, but mark-to-model. That means you can make up any figures you want to and see how great we're doing. But ladies and gentlemen, you know, the old adage is that figures don't lie, but liars can sure figure, and this is what they were. I think that Dr. Corsi is absolutely right. It was a public relations stunt, and the people always fall for it. After all, our government officials wouldn't lie. They're there to help us, or are they? We'll be back in just a moment. Well, go right ahead, Jerry.
Well, Dexton, you're exactly right about the mark-to-market. The rules were changed, and the banks no longer have to mark their troubled assets to market. So they can have a model, market to the model, which is the stress test model. These stress tests, to me, are not proving that the banks are going to be able to sustain real losses if they had to have real assets. In other words, if the assets they had were mark-to-market, we'd still be back again with of the 20 banks that were tested, the top 19, probably 10 of them would be insolvent. So right now, I think the real agenda of these stress tests is, and I wrote this in Red Alert, is an attempt, an excuse to nationalize the banks. What you have is that, let's just take Citicorp or Citigroup, which is going to have to raise something like $50 billion in new capital. Bank of America is going to have to raise 30 or 34 billion in new capital. I think the total together is 75 or 80 billion dollars of these top 19 banks, and it's still not entirely clear that that's all they're going to be required to raise. Now, these banks are not going to be able to go to the private capital market and raise this. I'll come to that in a minute, but the way that the Obama administration has treated Chrysler and GM, the what's called the political risk, the fact that private capital might not get fairly treated by an ideological administration. I mean, it's almost like the United States is a third world country where the dictatorship can say, oh, I'm sorry, we're nationalizing all the institutions. So here, when these banks are saying they need, let's say Citigroup needs to raise $50 billion in new capital, well, the government, the Obama administration is going to very conveniently say, well, we've given you bailout loans. We've taken preferred stock for those bailout loans. Why don't you just convert our preferred stock into common stock? And that way our loans you'll now be able to record as capital. And I'm sure that the public will not understand this in large measure because many people have not got any experience in finance. Many people are not investors or have never worked for boards where they've had to manage public corporations. So what will happen is the public will say, oh, well, look, isn't this great? The government's helping the banks. But what the government is doing is taking over the banks. And nationalization is a key characteristic of a socialistic state. So you have essentially the central government control and management even more than ever was done during the Depression with the New Deal. New Deal did not take over banks.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Corsi. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess there's Dr. Jerome Corsi of WorldNet Daily and certainly one of our favorite guests. And he was simply talking about the massive amounts of money that many of these banks are going to have to raise, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, they're all, you know, we're talking $75, $80 billion, not million dollars, but billion dollars. And as he points out, you know, they have a gimmick that's called converting preferred stock to common stock. Now, most people don't really understand how this works, but basically, the government has lent these banks a great deal of money. It is then recorded as preferred stock, and of course, it is considered a loan to the bank that has to be repaid. But if they could simply convert the loan to common stock, then what was before a loan now becomes an asset, and voila, why you look at the figures, and these banks are really solvent. Of course, they're solvent because why now? Of course, the government owns a great deal of stock in the company. The value of the stock of everybody else has fallen in value. But the frightening implication is we're moving towards a fascist society where the government controls the corporations and the corporations control the government. They become one and the same. That's what Benito Mussolini has, and that's sort of where we're heading today, isn't it, Jerry?
Very much, and people have to remember, I refer always to Jonah Goldberg's book on liberal fascism, that fascism in the 30s started from the political left. It was the National Socialist Party that became the Nazis, and of course, in Russia, the Soviet Union, it was a leftist communist revolution. So both fascist states emerged out of leftist politics. And we're seeing the same. Let's just take a look at the Chrysler restructuring. And I think it's, again, illustrative of what the Obama administration is doing. The Chrysler bailout didn't work. And Chrysler, in the last hours, the secured creditors, the people such as hedge funds that had lent Chrysler money but yet had a secured position, in other words, they had a claim on Chrysler's assets, did not want to simply take the 29 cents on the dollar that the Obama administration was offering, especially not when the union, the United Auto Workers, UAW, which had been owed about $20 billion in their pension fund, one of their pension and wealth and health benefit fund, the VEBA fund. What Obama said to the UAW is, well, you take 50%. You take, forgive $10 billion of what Chrysler owes you, but in return we'll give you 55% equity stake, a common shares in the company, in Chrysler, which is completely unfair because the UAW is a junior unsecured lender, which means they don't have any position on the debt of the to get their debt exchanged for equity. They don't have any real claim on the assets of the company. And among the secured creditors were four banks that had taken bailout funds, including Citigroup and Goldman Sachs. And the Obama administration strong-armed those four banks, saying, you've taken our bailout money, so now you'll do what we want. That is, forget about your secured position in the bankruptcy. Just take the 29 cents we're offering you. And they did. And then what got reported in the business press was that a pressure was put of a major nature. This Governor Jennifer Granholm, the Democrat in Michigan, and various members of Congress from Michigan began calling the secured lenders who were the holdouts and threatening them. They would never do business again in Michigan, threatening their, which is really a form of extortion, unless they agreed to the Obama administration plan. Further, Obama brought in Fiat and said Fiat was going to get 20% of Chrysler just for bringing small car technology to Chrysler. Now, Fiat wasn't going to put a penny into the deal, but between the government, Fiat, and the UAW, this was going to be close to 85% of the company or more, maybe as much as 90% of the company owned, and the secured lenders were really going to get nothing. The current common shareholders were going to get reduced to a very small position. And essentially, this was a government union takeover of the car company. And the Obama administration was saying, isn't this wonderful? We're helping the workers and the taxpayers. Well, in the process, the Obama administration was violating every form of corporate law or bankruptcy law that has typically put secured lenders in a priority preferred position. And as doing that, it causes political risk in the future to any private investors who are thinking about putting capital into U.S. businesses.
Well, I think the significant thing is what they're doing is saying, we don't care what the laws are. I mean, we don't care what bankruptcy laws are. We're above the law. We will make the decisions, and everybody will go along with us because we're in charge here. And this is rather frightening because it means whatever contract you may have on anything, you know, they could simply negate that contract by some sort of a bureaucratic edict. That was what was so frightening to me.
Well, that's right. All contract law now and all corporate law, all bankruptcy laws, the Obama administration simply threw out the window. They're saying, we don't care. We have this political solution. Our political solution, of course, is to benefit the union. The union workers voted for Obama, and Obama's going to go to the people and say, look, these terrible bankers, they're the bad guys, and I'm going to fight for the union. They're the good guys. But that violates contract law, it violates corporate law, it violates bankruptcy law, and the detriment is not only that it's intrinsically wrong, theft, but down the road, it's bad business. Because if the government also has told these same hedge funds that the government wants the hedge funds to participate in public-private partnerships to buy troubled assets off bank balance sheets. Now, what investment firm is going to go along with the Obama administration in private capital deals of that nature when you get treated so badly?
Well, not only that, but
you rely on corporate law.
But if you go into a deal, say to try to buy up the mortgages or these so-called collateralized debt obligations, and you're in this deal with the government, they can change the rules any time. That is what they established with the Chrysler bailout. We make the rules. The rules that are there have nothing to do. I mean, we're in charge, and you borrowed money from us, you will do what we say. And telling that to the major banks, and you will do exactly what we say. And now they're telling the hedge funds that. I think that you're absolutely right. What corporation, what firm, what pension fund, what hedge fund in their right mind would want to get into any sort of a deal with the government when they could change their mind at any time and leave you holding the bag?
Well, in the rules of private investing and in the finance world, there are any number of risks you take. You take business risks that the venture might not work. There's also what's called political risk. So, for instance, let's say you're investing in a third world country or a Latin American country where coups are common and the government's nationalized businesses and you lose your equity stake because the government just took over the business and said, we don't care about the private investors. Well, essentially, the Obama administration has just made the United States into a third world nation in our disregard of contract law, corporate law, or bankruptcy law. So now private investors investing in the United States have to take into account political risk that has never before had to be accounted for, which means that we're going to dampen significantly the capital development, which we need in order to really get out of a deep recovery, a deep recession into a recovery, or to build a strong economy in the future. Capital is not going to come to a country where the Obama administration, by whim, can just politically restructure companies like Chrysler and GM.
I share your concern. I don't think most people really realize the implications of what has really happened. And why are they so intent upon giving Chrysler basically to Fiat? And Fiat's apparently going to end up owning a significant part of that and directing this thing once it's all over.
Well, the whole issue with Fiat is another political agenda. The Obama administration has a resentment to Americans driving big cars and to Americans using a lot of energy. So it's largely covered up by this carbon agenda, where the Obama administration bought into the global warming hysteria. We can get to that, but that's another hoax. We've talked about that before, Dr. Stan. There's no basis in science for really thinking that human activity is creating global warming. That's a hoax. I'm not even sure there is global warming. And we see that with the cap and trade, with the carbon emissions tax that the Obama administration wants to place on the entire economy. So with biofuels, with alternative energies, okay, now comes the agenda from the Obama administration that Americans shouldn't be driving big cars. Obama's talked about designing these plug-in hybrids, and Fiat is supposed to be able to come over and design these for Chrysler. Now, the problem is that There's no experience that Fiat has which demonstrates it's going to be successful in the United States marketing cars or making cars that people will buy. And as long as gasoline stays at $2.25 a gallon, there's not going to be much appetite in the American car market for buying these plug-in hybrids. And I think, Dr. Stan, that that's one of the things the union and the government ought to take into account and be concerned about. If Chrysler can't make a profit, it won't make any difference that the union owns 55% of it. Chrysler will still be bankrupt, and it will still need more government bailouts just to keep operating, even with Fiat at the management.
Well, you know, I think one of the big things that we have to consider is, when is this economy going to turn around? As long as the economy is down, as long as we're in a recession or bordering on a depression, people aren't going to buy cars. So, you know, how long can they hold out? A year? 2 years? 3 years? When is the recession going to end? They don't know. But, of course, the car market is not going to come back until, of course, we're out of this recession. And we could bump along the bottom here for 4 or 5 years. You pick up the story there, Jerry.
Well, I think I understand there's no indication at all, as far as I can see, that we're going to come out of the recession anytime.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
And certainly we've gone from 6,500 to 8,500, but it's fallen from over 14,000. So certainly this is not that much of a recovery. I think if people, you know, have recouped some of their losses, it'd be a great time to get out. I don't know how much further it's going to go up, but I think it's got a lot further to go down. It's just a matter of when it turns down south again. But what they do is they play games with our minds, and people feel so good when the market's going up, and they feel so bad when the market's going down, not realizing that many times the market is manipulated. Certainly the commodities have been manipulated. Everything is manipulated to create our reality. And this is the unfortunate thing, that the natural forces, the economic forces, are not allowed to really participate in what's going on. Certainly, if the government would get out of the way, the whole thing would correct itself. But everything the government is doing in the way of pouring out countless trillions of dollars, and certainly we don't know how many trillions of dollars. Some people say 4 trillion, some people say at least 12 trillion has been pledged or lent or given. We don't know. We don't know where a lot of it's gone. And then nobody's about to tell us, common people. All we do know is that there seems to be a little clique that seems to be controlling it, tied into Goldman Sachs, and whether it would be Mr. Geithner, who is a disciple of Robert Rubin, who used to be the CEO of Goldman Sachs, or Henry Paulson, the former Secretary of the Treasury, who was CEO of Mr. Friedman, who just resigned today as president of the First Federal Bank of New York, who had heavy investment in Goldman Sachs, or Mr. Libby, who is in charge of AIG and dispensing all sorts of money from AIG, well, really American tax dollars that are given to AIG and then giving them to Goldman Sachs, and he's heavily invested in Goldman Sachs. And I would think that some people might, if they had a suspicious mind, might think there was a little conflict of interest there.
Well, there is a substantial conflict of interest, and I think Goldman Sachs has been largely putting the entire economy into play. My next book is Putting America for Sale. America for Sale will be my next book in October. And I think that's what Goldman Sachs is basically doing. They're creating a situation where the assets of the United States will quickly be being sold off to foreigners, because we're in a situation of true capital. This is a capital deficiency recession. It's not a credit problem. It's people saying, oh, well, this is caused by lack of credit. No, that's not the case at all. We had overabundant credit when interest rates were artificially kept low at 1% in 2003 and 2004 by Alan Greenspan. That's when the mortgage bubble started. And between interest rates low and especially the Democrats pumping up Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in Congress, demanding that they securitize subprime mortgages, sell them off as if they were grade A securities, that created an artificial bubble boosting all home prices across the country. That was because of excess credit. It's like people were borrowing against their homes on various kinds of home loan, using their homes like an ATM machine and credit cards. We've just been through a credit bubble. And what the Obama administration is doing right now is trying to get out of the recession by another bubble. We're not creating real jobs. We're not creating real capital development in the United States. What we're doing is deficit spending of an unprecedented nature. $3.4 trillion budget in which we're going to have to borrow probably $2.5 trillion this year and maybe $4 trillion in 2010. Now, if that's the case, it's just another bubble. It's just another borrowing and the creating of social welfare programs and government jobs don't really create economic value. Give an example, Dr. Stan. Someone is unemployed and they get unemployment insurance. Well, it's great to get unemployment insurance for a while, but that just replaces income. It does not create a job, or it's not capital-intensive production of real value. And that's why social welfare programs have such a low multiplier effect. They don't typically generate very many jobs.
It was very interesting today. President Obama said, now if you're running out of your unemployment insurance, why, don't you worry? Why, if you just go off and you go to college, why, we'll continue your unemployment insurance. Well, what we need is saving and production. What they are stressing is spending and consumption. The whole idea, get people buying things and using things, but it doesn't produce wealth. Wealth comes from production. Wealth comes from saving. And both of them are being actively discouraged today. And we're borrowing, as a nation, close to $3 billion a day, and soon it'll be far more than that. We'll be right back. Go right ahead, Jerry.
Well, Sam, if we continue on this, and let's say Obama says, okay, fine, if you're running out of your unemployment insurance, we'll go back to school, get training, and we'll continue your unemployment insurance. Now, the problem is all of these programs are just dependent upon more deficit spending. The government's tax revenue, as the jobs shrink, and as the manufacturing base of the country shrinks, as the consumption drops, and there's even retailing is suffering. The only retailers that are really doing anything at all are like Walmart, just like the only restaurant chains that are doing well are McDonald's, the bottom fishers, the ones selling the Chinese goods, or the lowest possible price outlets even for food. Yes, they've got a market now because people are struggling to have any money at all. But at some point or other, the federal government can't borrow anymore. China's already said that they've had enough of buying U.S. debt. China now has $2 trillion in foreign exchange reserves. That's the most any country's ever had in the history of the world. About 80% of it is in U.S. assets, about $800 billion in U.S. treasuries. Well, China has actually begun selling some of its U.S. assets and buying gold for its foreign exchange reserves. And the Treasury, which is now at the point of borrowing about $100 billion a month, I think it's going to start increasing to about $200 billion a month. If you watch very closely, Dr. Stan, the long-term Treasury notes, the 10-year Treasury bill and the 30-year Treasury bill are going to start increasing in their yield. We've already got the 10-year note over 3%, and it was under 3% just a little while ago. It's because you have to increase the yield of these notes in order for anybody to buy them, because people going to buy government debt just don't want to do it anymore. Too risky. Government at some point or other is going to default on the debts. It looks like to me that the Barack Obama administration will increase of the $10 trillion national debt they inherited when George Bush left office by 65% in 2 years. If that's the case, it's inevitable that we're going to be approaching double-digit interest rates and the currency will have to devalue.
We'll hold that thought for just a moment here and we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan and our guest is Dr. Jerome Corsi, talking about really what's going on and the fact that we're going to be developing a massive debt. I mean, certainly when the Obama administration came in, the debt was about $10.05 trillion, something like that. That's, of course, what they talk about. The real debt is about $65 trillion. If you use the general accepted accounting principles, that's GAAP, general accepted accounting principles. But as they say, figures don't lie, but liars can figure. So the government doesn't do what they insist the corporations do, use the GAAP. They have their own system by which they steal money from Social Security, and they've been been doing it for years, ever since Social Security was created, especially since the Johnson administration, where they just take the Social Security money in and spend it, and then they put an IOU in, but there's no money behind the IOU. But now this year or next year, why, there's not going to be enough money coming in from Social Security. There's going to be nothing to steal. There's not going to be anything to steal from the Medicare system. So now what are they going to do? Where are they going to get the money? If they raise taxes, people will be mad at them. So, of course, they can simply borrow the money from other countries, but what happens if they won't lend any money anymore? Well, then they just print the money. They monetize the debt. They simply do what they did in the Weimar Republic or in Zimbabwe. We just create the money, and that solves all the problem. And we never worry about tomorrow because we can live so well today. Well, before we go on, Jerry, would you like to tell our listeners how to get your website, how to get your information?
Well, it's at WorldNet Daily. Is where I'm writing, worldnetdaily.com. I'm a senior staff reporter. I'm writing there on a regular basis. My economics newsletter, Strategic Economics Newsletter, which I write weekly, is Red Alert. And you can see it at redalert.wnd for WorldNet Daily, redalert.wnd.com. You actually have to type all that in to go to the Red Alert website, redalert.wnd.com. And we feature a lot of the articles from Red Alert on the homepage of WorldNet Daily. If you click through to those, you can also get to the Red Alert website. My two latest books, The Obama Nation, which I wrote during the presidential campaign, was number one New York Times bestseller for a month. It's still selling quite well on Amazon. And The Late Great USA on the coming merger with Mexico and Canada, it is now in paperback for about $10 on Amazon with a new epilogue. So that is also doing quite well. It was a New York Times bestseller as well when it came out in 2007.
Well, I'm sure we carry that one. I'm not sure whether we carry the Obama, the Abomination, but I've read the book. It's an excellent book. Well, certainly, as we look and see what's going on, the average American, I don't think, really can quite grasp the severity of the situation we're in. Certainly, if they've still got a job, everything's all right. You know, they're living pretty well. But, you know, what we're seeing is more and more of our states, more and more of our cities and counties are having to cut back dramatically because, of course, they're not getting the sales tax receipts. They're not getting the property receipts. Property values are falling, and, of course, then taxes are falling. And so many of our cities and counties, there's even serious question that they will default on their bonds and that many of our major corporations are going to default on their bonds, certainly as General Motors and Chrysler and the others have done. What will the implications be if the bond market begins to collapse?
Well, it's starting to already. The states and the localities, you're going to see the $787 billion that Barack Obama put through as an economic stimulus plan, about $140 billion of it is for states, that budget deficits, shortfalls. But that's not going to cover more than about 40% of what I think is going to be the actual number by the end of the year, 2009, of the state deficits that are truly there. So increasingly, states like California are going to be right on the edge. They're going to be, and Schwarzenegger, Governor Schwarzenegger is already talking about legalizing marijuana for recreational use. Well, even if Governor Schwarzenegger did that, it would probably generate about $1.6 billion in revenue. That's the estimates that I've seen out of California. But California is facing a $20 billion shortfall on their budget. So they could marijuana, cocaine, they could methamphetamines, they could legalize whatever they wanted in California. It's still not going to meet the budget deficit because California is losing jobs and losing businesses and has become one of the highest tax states in the nation.
I think it was really very interesting, of course, being a citizen of California. I've been watching very carefully, and if they were able to get through the propositions A, B, C, D, E, and F, why then they would be able to squeak through. I mean, that would take care of the $40 billion deficit they were looking at. And so they've calculated that, and, oh, we're going to be in good shape. And that's just within the last week. They found, whoops, there's another $20 billion deficit. What are they going to do about that? In fact, I understand that Arnold Schwarzenegger is thinking of retiring next year and giving up politics. I wonder why. Go right ahead.
Well, California is just not going to survive. And what you're going to see happening in California is going to be dramatic cuts in schools, in hospitals, in police, in all social welfare benefits. And California is going to become a very dangerous place to live in. Right now, California is having fires in Santa Barbara. There's billions of dollars being poured into that rescue effort. In the future, areas like Santa Barbara are just going to be allowed to burn. You're seeing California having illegal immigrants, which come across the border in millions, and California is one of the states in which they live in the largest numbers. California and Texas, New Mexico and Arizona. Of course, they illegal immigrants are throughout the country, including in New Jersey, where I live, in New York. I think virtually every state in the union. But in California, the illegal immigrants are getting their children educated in the public schools in Spanish. They can go to the emergency rooms and hospitals and get primary care. And if the hospital doesn't provide it, the hospital can lose its federal funding and be shut down and sued. So I think there's, you know, I've counted over 140 hospital closings in California in the last 5 years, and I think you're going to see another wave of hospitals have to close in California. So California, if you want to drive your car and have good roads, if you're relying on police or fire services, good schools, forget it. California is going to become a second-class state, and there's going to be constant fights with the public unions, the workers' unions, and with the governor about cutbacks in workers' union wages, workers who are laid off. You're going to see threats back and forth between the Obama administration and California to cut off funding if the then the socialist mentality, the social welfare state mentality, Barack Obama intends to maintain all these social welfare state services, even if the federal government's broke, and even if the states are broke. The federal government is just going to, if Barack Obama can have $2.5 trillion borrowed in 2009, which I'm saying is going to happen, I think you're going to hear Monday or Tuesday that the real deficit is going to have to be admitted in 2009 is $2 trillion. I think it's going to be $2.5 trillion. And I think the real deficit in 2010 is going to be $4 trillion. Now, there is no way that the federal government can borrow $4 trillion. What we're doing is we're setting up the Federal Reserve to begin borrowing the Treasury debt, which is kind of like using the Visa card pay off the MasterCard bill. And already, if you take a close look at the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, it's swollen from about a half a trillion dollars to, I think, now $4 trillion. With all of the bailouts and the assets that they've had to buy, and now they're starting to buy at the Federal Reserve, government debt in federal, not only of the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but even Treasury bonds and bills. Well, if we start buying our own debt, we're going to see an interest rate environment. It's going to look again like we're headed towards the Carter administration. We're headed towards a very, very deep recession that's on the verge of a depression with 10% unemployment quickly before the end of the year, possibly going to 15% unemployment in 2010. With state after state not being able to meet, and cities. New York City, you're going to see two dozen cities look like New York in the 1970s, simply broke. And cities can't print money, and they can't borrow from foreign nations, neither can states. You're going to see the bond markets for states begin to dry up as well. So these conditions are going to be like a house of cards, or it's going to be one event triggering another, so that with double-digit interest rates and the dollar becoming devalued, going to hurt everybody's purchasing power. And the housing market, right now today with housing, they've gotten the housing rates down to about 4% for first-time buyers with all kinds of tax incentives. This is probably the best time ever for someone in the first house buyer to buy. But again, don't buy even as a first-time buyer unless you've got about a 20% down payment or more. And for other buyers, the interest rates are going to be between 5 and 6%. And refinancing is a good idea. But again, no one should buy any properties, including second properties or investment properties, even though there are deals out there, unless two conditions are met. The property value is half of what it was at its peak value in 2006, because that's where property values are headed. And unless you can put 20% or more, and I'm saying put 50% into purchasing these properties as a down payment, so you have some security in that property. Double-digit interest rates are coming back, and when they do, the housing market is going to take another big hit. People don't realize it, but right now they're saying, oh, the economy, there's signs of, there's green sprouts. If you turn on CNBC and listen to them cheerlead the stock market all day long, you'll hear them talking about green sprouts. And they'll set out Austin Goolsbee from the White House, and he'll talk about how great the stimulus is doing and the stock market's coming back. I just don't believe it. We're about to have a double dip in the economic downturn when some of the impacts of this massive federal borrowing actually hit.
I think that you're absolutely right, because what really concerns me most is the fact that when you start to monetize the debt, in other words, when the government starts to create money or credit or call it what you will, to begin to buy its own debt, you begin to expand the money supply. And, of course, inflation is not rising prices. Inflation is increasing the money supply. And, of course, the prices go up in response to the increase in the money supply. And, of course, somewhere down the line, I believe we're going to get into a hyperinflationary spiral that could simply wipe out the pension funds, the insurance policies, the annuities, the bank deposits, the bonds, everything people has, you know, invested in that is denominated in dollars. People say it couldn't happen here. Well, I remember I lived over in South Africa in the mid-70s. It was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful place. I just got a letter today from one of my friends who says that the hospital where I worked was a black hospital, excellent facilities, excellent care. The only trouble is they've closed down the surgery there. There's no money. There's no medicine for the people. 50% unemployment. I mean, suddenly the very structure of their society is breaking down. This was a first world nation before the American State Department intervened and destroyed it, just as Rhodesia was a first world nation before the intervention by our State Department. It would appear we have some people working at the highest levels of our government in successive administrations who really aren't concerned about preserving the stability of society. And I think what's going on, certainly in Zimbabwe today, used to be called Rhodesia, in South Africa, in Southwest Africa, and in so many parts of the world, is a reflection of the attitude of our leaders as far as the world is concerned. And I don't like having those people in power. I don't care whether the Democrats or Republicans are in power. The same policies always seem to continue.
Well, the problem with the bureaucrats is they always, when they start running businesses or economies, apply their ideological preferences. Business is not an exercise in ideology. Business is an exercise in what's going to sell. What people want, what their demand is there to purchase. So ideologically now, we're going to see the U.S. car industry, there'll be a big relief when Chrysler's going to be restructured and GM is going to enter bankruptcy. By the end of May, GM will be also going into bankruptcy. I see no way it's going to be avoided. And the bankruptcy judge will be restructuring it. And they'll probably both emerge with a great deal of union ownership, government ownership, and I doubt if even the bankruptcy courts are going to take care of the secured lenders as well as they should be, because there's going to be so much political pressure even on the bankruptcy judges. If a bankruptcy judge can resist that, I'll be surprised and be curious to watch it. When these two car companies emerge as government-owned, worker union-owned car companies, very doubtful they'll produce cars that people want to buy or cars that have a profit margin to them. The typical SUV or pickup truck for the big three car companies the last 7 or 8 years have had a profit margin of between $7,000 and $10,000. Now, when you take a look at a small hybrid plug-in model car, it might have $1,000 or $2,000 profit margin. It may not even have that. And in the restructured Chrysler and GM, unless the unions are going to dramatically reduce their benefits and the legacy benefits of the retired workers, it's highly unlikely. The government is going to come in with fiat and a Barack Obama agenda, which is against carbon, it's against fossil fuels, it's against oil, it's against gasoline, it's against industrial activity. So you're going to have Chrysler turning out small cars. But even when people buy them, it's going to be problematic that Chrysler will make a profit. So that's the problem, is that the two problems with socialism are, one is eventually, like Margaret Thatcher said, you run out of other people's money to spend. Eventually, you can't borrow anymore. And the second problem is that central government management of the economy does not produce products that can be bought profitably for the company that's making them.
Yes, I love Winston Churchill's definition of the difference between capitalism and socialism. He always said that capitalism was the unequal distribution of wealth. Of course, socialism was the equal distribution of suffering. And I really believe that's exactly what we're going to see here in America. Because, of course, socialism doesn't work. It's a sincere, benevolent, idealistic theory. But somebody's got to be in charge, and the people in charge have their own agenda, and they're certainly not concerned about, in my estimation, the survival of America as a free society. We'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Our guest, Dr. Jerome Corsi. Well, Jerome, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program, and then we'll let you get to bed there, because I know it's getting late back where you live.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
With food prices soaring to all-time highs, as the dollar continues to fall in value, what can you and your family do to guarantee that fresh, nutritious vegetables will make it to your dinner table? Garden in a Can. Garden in a Can is your source for premium, long-term storable seeds. Garden in a Can is ready when you are. Plant them now or store them for when you really need them. There are 16 large, hermetically sealed, non-hybrid, open-pollinated packets of seeds, along with detailed planting instructions sealed in a can for ultimate long-term protection. Garden in a Can. It's that simple. Fresh, healthy, easy. Only $69.95 for over a half acre of safe, fresh vegetables. Ready when you are. Stop procrastinating and start preparing with Garden in a Can. For more details, visit GardenInACan.com today. That's GardenInACan.com or call 866-598-7396, 866-598-7396.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-
48927. And I think that Dr. Corsi is absolutely right. We're taking an economic crisis that could have been over in a year, year and a half, and we're going to drag it out to 10 years or more. There is no problem facing the United States today that a new government program won't make worse. And simply, we are doing everything we can to prolong this, but they're not going to tell the American people that, or that they really intend to do that. And these people are not stupid, ladies and gentlemen. They know that socialism doesn't work, but it's a path to centralizing power in the hands of the ruling elite. What does this Chrysler deal with Fiat have to do? Well, of course, nobody's going to tell you that the head of Chrysler just happens to be a member of the Trilateral Commission. That every president and or vice president of the United States from 1976 until 2008, every president and or vice president of the United States between 1976 and 2008 just happened to come from the membership rolls of the Trilateral Commission, and of course there's never been more than 80, 85 to 90 American citizens in the North American troop eligible to run for that presidency. Certainly three of the last four of directors of the Federal Reserve Board between 76 and 2008 came from the Trilateral Commission. 11 of the people from the Trilateral Commission hold the key positions in the Obama administration. The man who gives orders to the president every day is General James Jones, who's head of the National Security Council, and at a recent meeting of the security conference in Munich, and you can get this off the internet and right off the CFR's website, General Jones said, I take my orders every day from Henry Kissinger. We have a chain of command in the National Security Council, and I get my orders indirectly then through General Brent Scowcroft and Sandy Berger. But I take my orders every day from Henry Kissinger, and of course Barack Obama gets his orders from General James Jones. Understand that we do not have a free society. We have a small clique that runs this. You need to go to augustreview.com. You need, of course, to get my November, December, January, February, and March newsletters. They'll be up on the website there. You need to get them. You need to read them. You need to get the membership list of the Trilateral Commission, and we have that in the syllabus we call the membership list of the Brotherhood of Darkness. Who's in the Group of 30? Who's in the Bilderbergers and the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission? You can't tell the players without a program, and you're never going to have anybody tell you that the reason that we're turning Chrysler over to Fiat is because the CEO of Fiat just happens, just by chance, just by accident, just by coincidence to be a member of the Trilateral Commission, as are the people who control J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup. They get a little club, and they run the government, but they can't let the common people know that. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is radioliberty.com. Remember, the Conspiracy Conference is going to be held in Santa Clara on the June 6th and June 7th. And certainly if you want to get the telephone number, it's 925-449-6844. That's 925 888-449-6844 or simply go up to the internet, conspiracycon.com. Conspiracycon.com, that's the June 6th, June 7th, and I'm going to give the lead speech there on Saturday morning. Hope you can be there. And then, of course, our conference will be here on October the 25th in the Monterey Bay area, the annual Radio Liberty Conference. And Dr. Blaylock will be here. Tom Horn will be here. And we've got some great speakers coming. So we ask you, of course, to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, to get the Secret Mystery DVD series, takes you into the secret societies. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are secret societies. There always have been. Today, they're working at the highest level of our government, and then we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion. That'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of our good friend William Grigg. As we begin to look at what's going on in the world, certainly William Grigg was the senior editor of the New American Magazine for a number of years, and now he writes his own blog, writes his own books, and appears on radio programs. We're always pleased to have him with us. Hi, William. How are you tonight?
Dan, I am doing very well, and I really appreciate you having me as a guest again this evening.
Well, why don't you tell us, what are we going to talk about tonight?
Well, first of all, I owe you an apology. There was a miscommunication yesterday, and I wasn't able to be on your afternoon program because I had forgotten about it, and I had neglected the reminder to myself that I conventionally leave in my schedule. I just wanted to apologize publicly for leaving you not a guest yesterday. That was entirely my fault.
Well, I appreciate that, but I know you wouldn't do it intentionally. And, you know, we did have a guest. We had a whole flock of guests. We simply opened up the lines.
Well, that's wonderful.
But, you know, we really would far much have preferred hearing what you had to say than what I had to say.
Well, you're very kind.
But anyway, you go right ahead. And what are we going to talk about tonight?
I think we need to talk about this increasingly perplexing case of Ashton Lundy, the 16-year-old from North Carolina, who's been the subject of a lot of concern and a lot of outrage, a lot of the latter being produced by myself and a number of other people who rallied to his cause when his mother said that he had been detained under the USA Patriot Act and accused of phoning in bomb threats. And this is a story that broke about a week and a half or so ago in the local television media. And there were a number of things that were said in the course of an interview with Ashton Lundy's mother, Annette, about him being arrested by a gang of 12 FBI agents and then detained in Indiana under federal custody, supposedly under the Patriot Act. And in the course of the news clip that was on WRAL-TV in North Carolina, there was an interview with a former federal attorney who seemed to corroborate that this young man had been incarcerated under the Patriot Act. And I and a number of other people interviewed Mrs. Lundy, and she repeated to us that it was her perception that he was being confined under the Patriot Act, perhaps under a terrorism-related charge or something of that sort. And so a number of us reported in good faith the idea that this 16-year-old who's being held for making bomb threats by telephone as part of an internet prank was being confined under the draconian terms of a law which supersedes due process. Well, as it turns out, a lot of that's not true. The Patriot Act apparently is not implicated in this case. The mother was speculating that that was the case because she kept asking as to whether the Patriot Act applied in this particular instance. And she's told me repeatedly that she's never gotten a straight answer, which, of course, makes sense. There was a gag order on this case because it involved a juvenile. And just yesterday, around noon, I received a copy of a memo that had been circulated for law enforcement eyes only in Indiana that was a prelude to a press release that was issued later that day by the U.S. Attorney for Indiana, a fellow by the name of Capps, C-A-P-P-S, in which he disavowed any involvement in the Patriot Act in this matter. And so there is some ambiguity here, but as things stand right now, the account that was given by Ashton Lundby's mother was exaggerated to the extent that it implicated the Patriot Act. But there are some other interesting aspects of the case that would be worth some additional scrutiny and that would teach us some additional lessons about the circumstances we confront today with respect to due process.
Well, of course, had this young man been phoning in bomb threats or something of the sort?
That's something that's yet to be determined. His mother ardently insists that that's not the case, and there's reason to believe that he might be entirely innocent. And if indeed he was doing such things, that would be a very serious crime. But as things stand right now, he's legally innocent, which is to say he's not been...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. All right, you go ahead and pick up the story.
Yeah. As things stand right now, Ashton Lundby is legally innocent because he's not been convicted of a crime and not pleaded guilty. And furthermore, just as recently as a few hours ago, I was on the phone talking with his mother, and she insists that he is entirely innocent of the charges that are at the crux of the matter here. The first of which involves a bomb threat made to Purdue University on the 15th of February, and the other charges have to do with threats that were made by telephone. And these are all phony threats, incidentally. That's important to recognize here. Legally, a phony threat is a very serious crime. A genuine threat, of course, is a threat to commit mass murder, or at least to attempt mass murder. But a phony bomb threat is a serious crime because it does result in the disruption of people's lives. It steals from them their productive time. It can create circumstances which people get seriously hurt. It diverts emergency response teams from what could be otherwise very productive work. And it could create a situation where an emergency response team would respond to the wolf crier while somebody else who actually needs help is left without the help that paramedics or fire teams or police can provide. But in this instance, his mother, Ashton Lundby's mother, insists that Ashton has an airtight alibi for the 15th of February when a bomb threat was made against Purdue. That was a Sunday evening. And Ashton was in church in the company of at least 80 eyewitnesses. It wasn't just his mother who was there. You're talking about 80 people, most of whom were not only adult age, but middle age or older, and that they didn't get home until after the time that the bomb threat was phoned in. And then another set of charges deals with five calls that were made on March 5th to five different schools across the United States. They're all phony bomb threats. And what Mrs. Lundby says is that on the 5th, they actually received a phone call from the prankster who was making these phony bomb threats. She maintains that she has a voicemail recording with the voice of the bomb threat prankster, who was not her son. Her son was present with her when this message came in, according to what she told me. She says that they have text messages that were received from this prankster, who was actually phoning in the bomb threats and then framing her son, supposedly, for the bomb threats because her son did not want to call in the bomb threats. And the person that she accuses of doing this is a fellow from Australia.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest is William Grigg. He's talking about this young man who's been arrested by the FBI, supposedly for putting in false threats. And the mother claims that the real culprit is somebody over in Australia who had wanted the son to go ahead and phone in the bomb threats. He wouldn't do it. But go ahead, pick up the story.
Yeah. The person she accuses of doing all of this, of stealing her son's internet identity and using it to call in these phony bomb threats, and she says that she has text messages which confirm this, is a fellow by the name of Jason Bennett, who's a 19-year-old from Australia, whose acquaintance Ashton Lundeby had made online through a gaming community. And this requires a little bit of explanation here. There are a number of social networking sites on the internet. Some of them facilitate activities of the sort that I will certainly discourage my own children from getting involved in. These social networking sites are loosely connected to the gaming culture, online video gaming culture, interactive gaming. Jason Lundeby was involved very heavily in the gaming culture. And through his involvement in this culture, he ended up allegedly being part of a group of adolescents who would be involved in phoning in pranks, pulling pranks, and then watching them unfold in real time online. And Annette Lundeby admits that he did many of these things, that he was involved in pranking people in sort of a cyberspace updated version of Alan Funt's Candid Camera or some of the other prank shows that you might recall from history. They're not particularly nice things to do. They're obnoxious. They're intrusions on people's privacy. I think that they're all very bad and very abusive things to do. But she maintains passionately and in an unequivocal sense that he never had anything to do with the bomb threats. That she admits that he had an online pseudonym of Tyrone, and Tyrone was involved with this group of people who were apparently calling in bomb threats, and at least one person was involved in calling in bomb threats for hire, which is to say that a group of kids who might want to be dismissed from school early on a given day would pay this individual to phone in a bogus bomb threat so that school would be let out and they wouldn't have to spend their time confined in a classroom. She admits, Annette Lundeby, that her son was Tyrone, but she insists that Tyrone's identity was stolen by the person who's actually doing these pranks for hire. I don't know whether or not that's the case, but there's actually some circumstantial evidence, first of all, that there was some kind of a blending or misrepresentation of identities online. It's something that's fairly easy to do if you know the protocols and if you have a sufficiently devious mind. There is one documented instance in which somebody with this little group was involved in calling in a bogus crime report that set up another member of that group for an encounter with the police. And so we do have instances here of people being impersonated online, and we do have an instance where, for purposes of indulging some malicious sense of humor, members of this group have been set up by the police, or set up for some kind of an aversive encounter with the police. And that Lundeby tells me that there's actually an incident where the police there locally in Oxford, North Carolina, were alerted. They live in Granville County, North Carolina, a little town called Oxford. The local police were told that the Lundeby residence was involved somehow in an incident involving narcotics, and they ended up getting a phone call from the police about this. Now, a lot of these things, of course, are relatively easy to verify. If the FBI wanted to check on whether or not that call had been made to the local police or the county sheriff's department, falsely reporting that there were narcotics at the Lundeby home, that's something that they could verify very easily. They can check with the eyewitnesses from the congregation, the Methodist church that the Lundeby family attends in Kittrell, North Carolina, which is a considerable distance away. They went, Annette Lundeby says they went after church to a local grocery store to buy cat litter and cat food for their three felines. There should be security camera video available if the Lundeby's were there at a given time, thereby establish whether or not the alibi that his mother says, Ashton's mother says is airtight, really holds up. And with respect to the idea that the internet identities would be stolen and that these malicious pranks would be carried out, that's something that, quite frankly, is beyond my competence in assessing here, because I don't know a whole lot about this this online subculture we're describing, but I'm assured that there are people with sufficient expertise that would be able to walk back these incidents and see if the claims that are being made by the Lundy Mrs. Lundy hold water. But most importantly here, Mrs. Lundy claims that there are key pieces of physical evidence that the FBI has ignored here. She says that they took every computer router in their home except for the wireless router that Ashton was using for his gaming activities, which I would think would be the crucial piece of hardware. She claims to have the voicemail recording of this individual who was harassing their family and impersonating her son, and she claims to have the text messages from this individual. I don't know whether those claims are genuine. She's making those claims. I think those should be investigated here, because right now there's a 16-year-old who's been held in Indiana at a county facility, but under federal jurisdiction for more than 2 months here, who's been accused of committing these crimes, which are basically glorified pranks, albeit of a potentially serious nature. And if he's convicted of these crimes under a federal statute that's about 70 years old, he can spend as much as 10 years in prison. They're talking about prosecuting him as an adult. He's a first offender. He's accused of being a first offender. He's not a convicted first offender, but this would make him a first offender if he were convicted. And so I think that there's sufficient grounds for concern here. Even if you take the Patriot Act element out of the mix, there's sufficient grounds for concern here over the possibility of overreaction and perhaps tunnel vision on the part of the federal prosecution.
But how's he actually been into court? In other words, the people have a right at least to be taken before a court to see if there's sufficient evidence bring charges against him.
Yeah. Well, there was a hearing at 10 o'clock in the morning on March 6th. And the important thing to recognize here is that during the time that the FBI was interrogating Ashton and his mother, and really, they, from what she described, they were pretty brusque about it. She was told to go up and bring her son down from his bed, and then one of the FBI agents went up and dragged the 12-year-old daughter out of her bed, which is the sort of thing that really, in particularly Southern culture, you simply don't do. You don't send an armed male stranger, into a 12-year-old girl's bedroom. That just doesn't work. But they were held from 10 o'clock till 1 o'clock or 1:30 in the morning before Ashton was taken away in handcuffs. They weren't permitted to call anybody, and of course it would be a terrible thing to be calling an attorney at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock in the evening, but there are attorneys who will respond. She wasn't able to contact an attorney before the hearing the next morning. She was given a court-appointed defense counsel for whom she has nothing but abundant and growing contempt. There are good court-appointed defense counsel. In my first essay about this case, I rather improvidently cast aspersions on the entire population of court-appointed defense counsels. I've had more than a few occasions where I've run into people in that line of work who are shills. They're basically there to be knocked down by the prosecution. And unfortunately, I painted with much too broad a brush, and I heard from a number of people who are doing, I would say, heroic work as court-appointed defense attorneys and defying the stereotype, much to their credit. How, unfortunately, the defense counsel was appointed by the court in this case, according to Mrs. Lundy, is the very embodiment of the stereotype, as somebody who's aggressively disinterested in what she considers to be exculpatory evidence, and somebody who accepts uncritically not only the federal prosecutor's theory of the case, but pretty much all the assertions being made by the prosecutor. This appointment was made because she wasn't permitted, and Annette Lundy was not permitted to get their own defense attorney. They simply didn't have time in the morning to go out and get an attorney of their choice, and so they've been stuck with somebody who's not been doing anything, according to Mrs. Lundy, to challenge what's going on with her son. There have been two hearings in North Carolina having to do with, there's one hearing in North Carolina, and then after the young man was moved from North Carolina to Indiana, apparently there were two more hearings in Indiana that Mrs. Lundy wasn't able to attend because it was simply too far away. She's a widow, a middle-aged widow with a 16-year-old son and a 12-year-old daughter, as well as grandchildren and an adult daughter whom she'd given up for adoption, interestingly enough, as a 16-year-old. So she's got a lot to take care of in North Carolina, and she doesn't have a great deal of financial resources that would permit her to travel to Indiana to attend court hearings. And not really a whole lot of money to hire a defense attorney of her choice, but she's trying to rectify that situation. The family is in a really interesting situation. From what I understand, what she told me is that her husband, her late husband, who died 3 years ago in June, was an officer in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And he died while they were living in Pennsylvania. And actually, no, forgive me. They had moved to Pennsylvania, and then apparently the couple separated, and she moved back to North Carolina. But the husband was planning on moving from Pennsylvania back to North Carolina. And just shortly before he did, he was to move back. He died under very mysterious circumstances. It was ruled a suicide. She's convinced it was not. There was a very perfunctory investigation made into his death. In the months leading up to his death, he was dealing with a number of severe problems having to do with identity theft. And this is something that's a leitmotif in the story that she's been telling me. Once again, she's the only source for the story, and I've not yet been able to corroborate these elements of the story, but she claims that her husband was the victim of identity theft, and that their bank accounts were being tampered with through people who were hacking into them using their identities, and that her son is also a victim of identity theft. And whether that's an outgrowth of their son's activities or whether that's the result of something completely different, I don't know. But once again, these are things that I think need to be looked into, and we're probably going to find out more about these things over the next several weeks.
Why would they move a young man from North Carolina to Indiana? That doesn't make sense. I mean, if the crime was supposedly taking place there, why would they move him such a great distance unless they were trying to prevent him from having any sort of a defense from his parents?
That is exactly what she says, and I think that that's a legitimate concern.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment right here at Radio Liberty. All right, William, go right ahead.
You bring up the issue of relocating Ashton Lundby in Indiana from North Carolina, and he's being prosecuted under a federal statute. It's a statute which has been on the books for about 70 years, Title 18, Section 844, Subsection E, that makes it a felony to issue a bomb threat, whether a legitimate one or a phony one, using the mail, telephone, telegraph, or other instrument of interstate commerce. That would, of course, include the Internet. And a telephone was used in this instance, with the Internet being used to capture the reactions of people to the bomb threat, allegedly. And so he's being held under federal authority at a county juvenile detention center in Indiana, in South Bend, which is, of course, the home of Notre Dame, a couple of other universities, a couple of other schools, rather, a couple of other colleges. The thing that I find really interesting is that if you're going to be prosecuting him for a bomb threat, it seems to me that the constitutional approach here would be to prosecute him under Indiana law, because you're dealing with an offense, an alleged offense that took place against Purdue University in Indiana. Interestingly enough, a bomb threat, a phony bomb threat, under Indiana state law is a Class B misdemeanor. It's not a felony. And if you issue a phony bomb threat in such a way that somebody actually gets hurt, then the offense is enhanced to a Class A misdemeanor. But it still falls short of an offense that would require actual prison time. And if you're dealing with a first offender here, and the specific offense was one that took place in Indiana, then the appropriate thing to do would be to prosecute him under Indiana state law, first of all, and find out if indeed he's guilty of committing this particular act, particularly if you're dealing with a first offender. But the fact that he's been accused of these five other bomb threats on the 5th of March against five other schools puts it in an even more curious light that he's being held in Indiana, because there's no reason to hold him in Indiana if he's being accused by the feds, if they have a case for him as the serial prankster who committed these acts against not only Purdue, but against high schools and other institutions across the country. There's no reason to hold him in Indiana, except, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, for the geographic isolation that would involve. And one of the points that his mother has brought up, and this is something she researched by herself because she said her defense attorney has not provided her with any help, is the fact that under the 1967 Supreme Court decision in Ray Galt, There are certain due process considerations having to do with the disposition of a minor who's suspected of a crime that she believes are not being observed in the case of her son's detention. She believes that they're holding him on the assumption that he's presumptively guilty. As a matter of fact, somebody close to the prosecution said to me that the reason why they are detaining him is to keep him from making bomb threats. And, of course, that assumes the guilt of the suspect here. And under Galt, that's impermissible. Of course, under the Constitution in general, it's impermissible to treat somebody as guilty until proven innocent. You can detain somebody, of course, if you've got a strong case of probable cause, a specific criminal charge, and you've met the qualifications of habeas corpus. But what's going on here is that the reason that they would be detaining him, according to this source, which is very, very close to the prosecution of the case, and who approached me a couple of days ago with some information that I've put on my blog and on the Lou Rockwell blog, is that they wanted to make sure that this delinquent was not making these bomb threats. Well, that's all very well and good if you happen to have the right guy.
Hold that thought just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris, talking to Will. I mean, the question is, why is this young man being kept in prison? Well, of course, the justification that Will has been told by somebody very close to the prosecution is that they're afraid that he's going to make more bomb threats. That's why they have to keep him in jail. But, of course, they've never proven that he has made any bomb threats. Now, is there an opportunity for him to get bail?
Apparently not. That's the other part of the case that made his mother suspect that we're dealing with the Patriot Act situation, because there are provisions of the Patriot Act that apply when you're talking about something that is considered an act of terrorism or a threat to national security. And so that's one element of this that makes me suspect that they're being disingenuous, that the federal prosecution is being disingenuous about the Patriot Act element or the lack thereof. They say that with respect to the Perdue case, that if you look at the press release that was issued yesterday, they say with respect to the Perdue case that the Patriot Act has nothing to do with this. If they're holding him as a suspect in these other suspected bomb threats, there might be a Patriot Act element having to do with those other cases. But the way that they've detained him and the way that they have manipulated his avenues of communication with his mother suggests that, to me, what they want to do would probably be to browbeat him into some kind of a preemptive plea bargain agreement and not even take the matter to trial. That's becoming very, very common as a tactic used by federal prosecutors and state prosecutors.
No, but of course, a 15-year-old boy cannot give his permission. You know, a plea bargain, it has to go through his mother.
Yeah.
And what she needs to do is get her own lawyer.
Yeah.
And even if she has to hawk the home, she needs to get a lawyer, somebody that can intervene in her son's behalf. And, you know, demand bail, and if they won't give the bail, then, of course, you know, certainly represent him. But you can't have somebody that is employed by the court, you know, to defend him, because they're not interested in justice. They're interested in conviction. You want as many notches as you can. Unfortunately, sometimes they send innocent people to prison just because it looks good on the record. And I hate to say that, but when you have an immoral organization in an immoral society, you've taken God out of it. Why should we be surprised if we get immoral actions by people who have under the so-called color of law? So basically, you know, I think that if the mother was really serious, she would have a lawyer and she would have somebody representing her son.
Yeah.
And I would think that there'd be some people who might simply be willing to do it at very reduced cost simply because it's a very prominent case and would give them exposure.
Yeah, that's precisely what I suggested to her when I first spoke with her on Tuesday. And she is, in the next week or so, going to be speaking with some people about that very issue. And this is something that underscores one of the most passionate objections that Annette Mundy has made here, which is that she was denied adequate time to find adequate counsel to represent her son, precisely because you're dealing with a 16-year-old. And Annette Mundy, as it happens, is somebody, I mentioned her late husband was in the Bureau of Prisons, employee of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. She briefly attended police academy herself. She's somebody who has been has a more than nodding acquaintance with the criminal justice system, and she made a point of telling her son while they were denied the presence of counsel while he was being interrogated by the FBI. she made a point of telling him, you don't answer the questions unless we have an attorney present. And so what she says is that she urged her son basically not to cooperate with the investigation unless they were provided with an attorney, and they were never given an opportunity to have an attorney present who would represent their interests as opposed to somebody who was appointed by the court, and that the court accepted uncritically everything that the FBI said, in spite of the fact that there were a number of things that the FBI said by way of the prosecutor at the first hearing, the initial hearing on the 6th of March, that were demonstrably true or untrue, rather, or immensely, eminently contestable if they had been given adequate representation. Now, you point out the fact that a 16-year-old can't make a plea bargain, which is true, and then you have a 16-year-old who is isolated from his parents and deprived of suitable legal representation. He's thousands of miles away from his mother. His mother could, of course, put a mortgage her home. I mean, right now it would be a really difficult thing. I don't know how much you get a mortgage on a home of that size in order to pay for legal representation. But once again, you're dealing with a widow of limited means and two small children to care for, so they're really in a very, very bad situation. But she is going to be exploring all alternatives that would be reasonable and promising next week.
All right.
That's what she has told me.
All right, fine. Because the thing is that I'm surprised she hasn't already gotten an attorney. You know, well, you're just going to have to do the investigative reporting on this. This is why we enjoy having it. But, I mean, there are a lot of things that go on, but you've got to hear all sides. You have to know what evidence they actually have. And, of course, why they would want to take a chance on imprisoning this young man. A suit could be brought against them for false imprisonment. Anyway, we're going to be back in just a moment with Mr. William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan William. Go right ahead with the story.
Well, one of the reasons why I was receptive to the idea that there might be a Patriot Act element to this story is the fact that the Patriot Act and state measures that were prompted by the passage of the Patriot Act have been used previously in the prosecution of very young juvenile offenders. There was a case in, I believe, 2007 involving a 14-year-old from Tempe, Arizona, by the name of Brent Clark, that involved, I believe, the Arizona state statute that was a knockoff of the Patriot Act. Now, Section 802 of the Patriot Act defines as terrorism practically any crime that takes place on so-called public property. If it's owned by the government, whether you're talking about a school or a library or another facility of that sort, and it is the scene of a violent crime, that violent crime under the Patriot Act can be prosecuted as terrorism. It's almost impossible not to find a violent act that would fall under the rubric of terrorism as defined by Section 802 of the Patriot Act and by the state statutes that include a provision akin to that. Well, this 14-year-old, who was a very disturbed young man, pulled a pocket knife on one of his classmates while they were on school property. And he wasn't particularly diligent in issuing the threat. It was really sort of an indifferent, desultory act. She ran away, and she told her parents what had happened. They called the police. The police went to visit the young man's home, and they found that he was somebody who, as is increasingly common today in our nihilistic society, had a fixation on the Columbine killers and so forth. And so you have here an act which could be called assault with a deadly weapon, or attempted assault with a deadly weapon. A pocket knife can kill a youngster. If you wanted to prosecute it as assault with a deadly weapon, that's a sufficiently serious charge with adequately severe penalties, I believe. But Andrew Payton Thomas, who's the hyper-ambitious prosecutor for Maricopa County, Arizona, decided he was going to charge this 14-year-old with terrorism for pulling a pocket knife on a classmate. And aided, I think, by the leverage of the terrorism charge, they were able to get a plea bargain out of the kid, and he's going to spend several years in prison. He was charged as an adult. He's 14 years old. There's another case just a year ago, April of last year, in South Carolina, involving a high school senior by the name of Ryan Schallenberg. Ryan's another troubled young man. We have a system which turns out troubled young men by the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. He another person who was sort of deeply...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is William Grigg, and we've been talking about some of the young people who have been charged under one or another guise of the Terrorist Act, the Patriot Act, and of course have been meted out very, very severe penalties. A 14-year-old boy who pulled a pen knife on somebody, and pocket knife, and got several years in prison. But then, you know, the thing that bothers me about what's going on is we're not allowed to discipline children in school. Our parents are not allowed to discipline children at home. But I will tell you that they're going to get plenty of discipline when they get to the penitentiary. Why can't we discipline children? I mean, the Bible tells us to bring up our, spare the rod and spoil the child. They know what they're doing. They're preventing parents and schools from disciplining. And that's why today in the United States, one in every 33 Americans is in prison, probation, or parole among the blacks. One in every three young black men, 21 to 31, prison, probation, or parole. And, of course, we can't allow discipline. Why? We might hurt their little psyches. Well, before we go on, William, I'd like you to go ahead and tell our listeners how they can get in touch with your blog and support you if they'd like.
Well, I sure appreciate that. The best way to find my writings is to go to willgrigg.com. WILLGRIGG.com. And if you go to that, it's basically a gateway or a portal. You look at the right-hand side of the screen, and there's a list of external links. And at the top of that list is a link to Pro Libertate, which is my blog. I update it between, 3 and 5 times a week with the fresh essay. As it happens, I've only written 2 essays this week. They both have to do with this case that I'm describing right now. The first one was published on Tuesday, and it was republished on the LouRockwell.com news page. Lou Rockwell is the president of the Von Mises Institute in Auburn, and I write a number of essays a month that are published by Lou Rockwell, republished from Pro Libertate. He also has a blog, a regular news blog, on the right-hand side of his screen. If you go to LouRockwell.com, look at the right-hand side of the Lou Rockwell page, there's a Lou Rockwell blog. I contribute items for that blog quite frequently, and this past week, as updates have been coming in on this case involving Ashton Lundy, I've been updating the original essay that I wrote. It's now, I think, 4 times the original size that it was when I published it originally on Tuesday, and just today I did an update for Lou Rockwell's website on that, and then just about an hour and a half ago, I finished an updated essay with the most recent developments in the Lundy case as I understand them. Those who are interested in reading what I have to say, go to willgrigg.com and then Pro Libertate. If you're interested in sending me support, there's contact information on Pro Libertate. Pretty soon we're going to be putting up a PayPal button. Hopefully that's something that we'll have up and running this next week. But one really good way to support my work, for those who are interested, is to buy my book, which is my most recent book is entitled Liberty and Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. At the bottom of every essay, there's a thumbnail picture of the cover of that book right next to a hyperlink, which will take you to Amazon.com to buy it. And it's also available through Radio Liberty. And I greatly appreciate your help in getting that book out to the public, Dr. Stan. It's been a real blessing.
Well, we're very glad, too. I think it's an excellent book. That's the Liberty and Eclipse. And, of course, you can get that by calling 1-800-544-8927 or 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's a good way to remember it. Right, yeah. Go right ahead, Will.
Well, we were talking about the really creative, I think the maliciously creative ways that prosecutors have of enhancing common crimes into political offenses such as terrorism. And we mentioned the case of Brent Clark, this 14-year-old who pulled a pocket knife on a young girl on the campus of the junior high school they both attended. And because this happened on government property, under the Patriot Act and Arizona's analog of the Patriot Act, this was redefined as an instance of terrorism. There's another case that I mentioned involving a young man who I think was 17 at the time of the offense, a young man from South Carolina by the name of Ryan Schallenberger. And once again, you're dealing here with somebody who is sort of product or a reflection of the hyper-materialist post-Christian sensate popular culture, because he was also obsessed with the Columbine killers. And it's sort of a passing adolescent nihilism that is very widespread, not nearly as widespread as some of the alarmists would have us believe, but there are sufficient causes for concern about the fact that there are people who, for whatever reason, in adolescence become fixated on people like the Columbine killers. And Mr. Schallenberger was one such. He at some point in his young life decided that he wanted to become a Dylan Klebold type of a killer. And his dream, according to the journal that his parents found, was to kill several people at his school and then be killed himself and then go to heaven and kill Jesus. He actually wrote that in his notebook. And now that obviously is an example of why we don't need prayer in schools, I suppose. I mean, heaven forbid, to actually teach kids piety as opposed to thoroughgoing pagan nihilism of that sort. But Ryan Schallenberger ordered a quantity of ammonium nitrate fertilizer that was delivered to the home he lived in with his parents when he was in school. You're dealing here with somebody who really doesn't have a real good mind for detail, obviously, because his parents had to sign for the ammonium nitrate. And they were puzzled why their son would be ordering fertilizer because he wasn't in SFA. So they looked through his possessions. They found his journal. They found his deranged, psychotic ramblings about committing acts of violence against his classmates. They called the local sheriff, and he was arrested, Ryan was, on charges relating to his plans to attack his schoolmates. Not content with the fact that you're dealing here with a series of crimes that are obvious crimes under South Carolina law, a federal prosecutor stepped in and charged Schallenberger with terrorism-related offenses involving a weapon of mass destruction. Now, you're dealing here with a 17, eventually 18-year-old kid who was trying to make a crude bomb out of distilled manure, and they call this a weapon of mass destruction. Now, the reason I'm underscoring that, first of all, is to highlight, once again, the creative perversity of prosecutors in finding some way to alchemize a common crime into an act of terrorism. But it's also worth pointing out that the federal definition of a weapon of mass destruction is not limited to things that we would consider to be traditional weapons of mass destruction, meaning nuclear weapons. I mean, that's really the only type of weapon to which the title WMD applies. There are ways of weaponizing various kinds of pathogens. Those, of course, are very sophisticated techniques which are well beyond the reach of even the most ambitious private citizens. You pretty much have to be a government in order to have a program to weaponize pathogens, just as you have to be a government in order to create a nuclear device. I don't consider chemical weapons to be weapons of mass destruction because they're a very limited battlefield utility. They can cause a lot of panic, as the Aum Shinrikyo sarin gas attack proved back in 1996 in Tokyo. But they're not really weapons of mass destruction. They're more like weapons of media destruction and mass annoyance. But under the federal statute that defines weapons of mass destruction, you read the following. A weapon of mass destruction is, and I quote, any incendiary, explosive, or poison gas, bomb, grenade, rocket having a propellant charge of more than 4 ounces, missile having an explosive or incendiary charge of more than 1/4 ounce, mine, or any type of weapon other than a shotgun or a shotgun shell, which the Attorney General finds is generally recognized as particularly suitable for sporting purposes, by whatever name known, which will or which may be readily converted to expel a projectile by the action of an explosive or other propellant, and which has any barrel with a bore of more than 1/2 inch in diameter. Now, that's a rather expansive definition of a weapon of mass destruction. As John Mueller, who sits in the Woody Hayes Chair on National Security Studies at Ohio State University, points out, under this definition, and I'm quoting now from Mueller, not only is a hand grenade a weapon of mass destruction, so is a maliciously designed child's rocket, even if it doesn't have a warhead. On the other hand, although a missile-propelled firecracker would be considered a weapon of mass destruction if its designers had wanted to think of it as a weapon, it would not be so considered if it had previously been designed for use as a weapon and then redesigned for pyrotechnic use, or if it was surplus and had been sold, loaned, or given to you under certain circumstances by the Secretary of the Army. The weapon of mass destruction designation likewise applies to all artillery and virtually every muzzle-loading military long arm, for that matter. It does make the bombardment of Fort Sumter all the more sinister, to say nothing of the revelation that the Star-Spangled Banner is, in fact, an account of a weapon of mass destruction attack on American shores, concludes Mueller. What this means, basically, is that anything you can devise that goes boom, or any firearm that you might possess, could be construed as a weapon of mass destruction if that definition happens to suit the interests of a federal prosecutor. Certainly, if you can accuse some addlepated 17-year-old who's trying to make a manure bomb of plotting an attack with a weapon of mass destruction, it stands to reason that practically anything else, however ineptly staged and malicious it might be on the one hand, or innocuous it might be on the other hand, involving any of these devices or substances, could likewise be prosecuted as a charge having to do with weapons of mass destruction. So once again, this is the sort of grotesque overreaching, the sort of malicious alchemy being carried out by prosecutors that made Annette Lundby's claim plausible when she said that the Patriot Act played a role in the arrest and detention of her son and the curious circumstances in which he finds himself now, separated by thousands of miles from his home, facing federal charges in Indiana, and not being in a position to do anything constructively towards obtaining an adequate defense. Given the fact that you have prosecutors that charge 14-year-olds with terrorism because they carry pocket knives to school, and 17-year-olds with plotting to use weapons of mass destruction because they want to build manure bombs, it seemed plausible to me when Annette Lundby said that the Patriot Act was being invoked to justify the detention of her son. As it turns out, what we know right now, to the best of our knowledge, the Patriot Act is not involved in any of this. He was arrested on charges that are serious, and he was given suitable legal representation, if not adequate legal representation. They did have proper hearings on the case. The arrest was conducted pursuant to a search warrant, and he's being held in a county juvenile facility in Indiana that is supposedly adequate and suitable for somebody his age, although he was held for 30 hours in North Carolina in the general prison general detention population with adult offenders, which was a horrible thing.
Well, first, the thing is that, you know, this young man should have had a lot of discipline. He was playing franks on people.
Yeah.
And I think the fellow who was going to build a manure bomb, if he couldn't have done it, wasn't his fault. I mean, this young man needed to be put away someplace.
Yeah.
Something had to be done to these people. The use of federal laws against them, however, is entirely inappropriate. We have plenty of local laws. We need a lot less federal prosecutors. You know, the thing we can hope for is they're going to run out of money. They're not going to have the money to spend. But with a boy who comes to school and pulls a knife on a girl, he has to be punished.
Yeah.
It's a shame he couldn't be taken out and he got a good whipping from his dad, but we couldn't do that. No, he's going to end up in prison and may end up as a permanent criminal because of the contacts he has.
Yeah,
the second boy, as far as the... he may never have been able to build a fertilizer bomb, but he had this in the back of his mind. Mm-hmm. He wanted to do great harm. Something needs to be done, this boy, whether it's psychiatric or imprisonment, but you can't have kids like that out in society. The question is, how do you deal with them?
Yeah,
and the federal government has no business taking care of them. They are a matter, should be a matter of the state or local government. I'm sure we would agree on that.
Yeah, and most importantly, it begins with parental discipline, which is something which is almost impossible to do now because the assumption is that discipline, punishment, are part of the monopoly of power that the government enjoys. So you disrupt parental discipline. You make it impossible for parents effectively to discipline their children without running the risk of losing their children to the Department of Child Services. You have a situation where people who act in loco parentis on behalf of the parents in the school systems, which is a bad idea to begin with, but it's a worse idea to let youngsters not have constructive discipline. You have a situation where people acting in loco parentis cannot effectively chasten or sanction or discipline children. And they grow up assuming that basically whatever occurs to them to do, no matter what harm they inflict on others, they should do it as a matter of expressing their own innate nature. And you end up with people who are precociously pagan in their outlook and precociously abusive of others. And you create a situation where they get into trouble that ends up being amplified by the creative mischief of the federal government expanding its own powers to capitalize on the problems the government has already created. That's part of the nasty dynamic we see in just about every issue. The government creates or exacerbates a problem, uses that problem to enhance its powers, and all the time it's constricting liberty and expanding the power of coercion in our lives. And so you end up with a situation now where the same 14-year-old who can't be effectively disciplined by his parents can be branded a terrorist for committing an admittedly serious act that really shouldn't be a federal offense, or an offense that's considered a political crime like terrorism. At the same time, you've got other elements of the federal government overreaching in other creative ways. The Congress is considering a hate crimes act right now that would institutionalize double jeopardy for certain offenses that are committed against certain specially protected categories of people, such as, primarily, homosexuals and other people of confused sexual identity. This would create a situation where if the local state officials don't prosecute supposed hate crimes, which is to say crimes that are considered offenses against a community of people, not just crimes against an individual, then the federal government will step in and prosecute these as hate crimes and bring about sentence enhancements in order to make some kind of conspicuous point about the political impropriety of certain types of offenses. And, of course, this wreaks havoc with due process and equal protection. It's something which is constitutionally impermissible. It's something which runs afoul of the concept of immunity against double jeopardy, which is something that antecedes the Constitution by several centuries.
Well, we've gotten away from that. If they don't get you, as they did with the people involved in the Rodney King case,
That's exactly right. The police officers,
they couldn't get them. They were exonerated by the state court, so they brought them up on federal charges. It is double jeopardy, but nobody wanted to say that. After all, why we had to bring justice. It was all about justice. Or was it really about justice? Was there another agenda? Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with William Gell. Certainly always a pleasure, but William Craig, I should say, right here. And I hope you enjoy William, who is with us every Friday evening at this time. Or we're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program right here at Radio Liberty. Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, first of all, it would have been a real pleasure to hear from William Gill this evening. I miss him.
I really do, too. And for our listeners, he was a gentleman who already, of course, was on the front lines of trying to preserve us from this globalization. And he believed, of course, that so many of the trade laws were wrong, were counterproductive, which they are. But go right ahead.
Yep. With respect to what we've been discussing this evening, you make, as is always the case, Dr. Stan, a very important and plangent point here about the fact that if we ignore the big serious laws that our Creator laid down for our benefit, then we get a thin drizzle of laws that is like an acid shower with respect to the foundations of our liberties. If parents aren't willing to discipline and they're not permitted to discipline to give useful correction and guidance in the upbringing of children, and then children will grow up crooked. And the corrections that are made by the state tend to enhance that crooked timber rather than to straighten it. And you end up with a situation where personalities become permanently warped in ways that are completely compatible with the statist and collectivist outlook, but utterly incompatible with the practice of living as individual, responsible individual, individuals blessed with freedom. And responsible individualism, of course, requires reciprocal respect for individual rights. And too many children and youngsters at the ages we've been discussing today are being raised to be takers. They're raised to have a predatory relationship with other people and look upon them as the butt of their jokes, whether you're talking about cyber pranks, the type we were talking about, or simply a source of amusement or provision in other ways, that's entirely compatible with the collectivist worldview, but that's incompatible with the worldview of principled free individualism. And so it all starts in the home, and when the home's not permitted to function, and the government's not allowing homes to function correctly, you end up with a situation of the sort where we have pranksters and bullies and miscreants, and thereby we cultivate all kinds of problems that from which the state harvests new powers that endanger the liberties of all of us. So if you have children, by all means, you take the initiative in training them how to live as principled, free individuals and to respect the rights of others. It's all based on the two great commandments. You know, the second commandment is love your neighbor as yourself. If we were to obey that commandment, and you know, of course, the first commandment as well, just those two commandments, we could probably turn around this failing society that we live in.
Amen to that. We're out of time. Our guest has been Will Grigg. And remember, you're to love the Lord with all your heart and all your soul, and your neighbor as yourself.
Exactly.
Good night, Will. God bless. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We do hope you enjoy our Friday evenings with William Grigg. And if you'd like to get copies of the program, why, of course, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Don't forget about the Conspiracy Conference. It's going to be on June 6th and June 7th. It's going to be in Santa Clara. And, of course, if you want to call and make reservations or get more information, why, you are to call 925-449-6844. That's 925-449-6844. I'll be giving the lead lecture on Saturday morning. Hope you'll be there. And then, of course, we will have our own conference, the yearly Radio Liberty Conference on October 25th. Put that aside, and God willing, why, we're going to have a great program. We hope many of you, of course, will want to get the material we have on the Deadly Assassins. It's a four CD set. You'll hear my interviews with a couple of CIA-trained assassins. We hope you'll want to get the four CD set on the Liberty, USS Liberty, that was off the coast of the Sinai back in 1967 war. And, of course, Israel sent planes to sink the ship and to torpedo it, but they were working in conjunction with the American State Department, with Robert McNamara, with President Johnson. The idea was to sink the ship and kill everybody on board, and then we would have a justification for going to war with Egypt. You need to get the four-tape set. We have a DVD called Dead in the Water, was produced by the BBC, totally suppressed here in the United States. Another video put out by the survivors, but suppressed here. And then, of course, we have a syllabus we put together. You can get the items separately or together at the Liberty Special, the USS Liberty Special. A four-tape set on the murder of, or I should say four-CD set on the murder of Martin Luther King, and who really did it. It wasn't James Earl Ray. A four-CD set on the murder of Bobby Kennedy, and of course we carry the book of, you know, Who Killed Bobby, and the DVD, RFK Must Die. Fascinating material, and you've never been told the truth. Once again, we have two four-tape sets on the murder of President Kennedy, the book, it's called A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza, and it's called Kill Zone, The Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza. We've got an excellent DVD on that, put out by a good friend, Bob Fletcher. All of these and so many more things are available at Radio Liberty. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We hope many of you, of course, lay in a supply of health products in case there is a problem. Lay in alibiotic and of vitamin D3, which at least our family takes if we feel we're coming down with the flu. Alibiotic is a combination of oil of oregano, elderberry juice, allicin, which is the active ingredient in garlic, and several other things. And we think it's an excellent source of protecting your body, helping your immunity. Fight off the flu. It's certainly a lot better than, in my estimation, than a lot of the things the government authorized, and certainly you do not want to take a vaccine. and you don't want to take a vaccine because you never know what they put in it. An awful lot of people have taken experimental vaccines when they were in the military and regretted it the rest of their lives. The same thing happened as far as, essentially, the Gulf War syndrome, which was related to the vaccines. People who didn't take the vaccines didn't get it. And of course, we see the same thing with autism. The Amish children who do not take the vaccines do not get autism and the other neurodevelopmental abnormalities that affect about 1 in 6 American children. So certainly the information you'll find in the DVD, Mercury Autism and the Global Population Agenda, which comes with a free CD-ROM with literally thousands of pages of documents on the toxicity of mercury. But don't you worry, we're still giving it to the little black children over in Africa. The people who are pushing the vaccination program are the ones who believe in population control. Why, if you believe in population control, would you be trying to save the lives of the little black children in Africa? Well, of course, remember our number, 1-800-544-8.